live from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont. We continue with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics. Tonight featuring commentary by Professor Art Sear of Carthage College, author of the book After the Cold War, and Robert Pape, author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. And our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289, in case you just tuned in. We have been talking about suicide terrorism, specifically suicide terrorism, and how it is rising in the world and what we might be able to do to stop it. And we've changed a few paradigms. The book is significant in the new information that it provides. And before the break, we were told by Robert Pape about a document which is revealed in the book, and briefly summarize what that document is for those that have just tuned in, Bob.
It's an actual Al-Qaeda planning document of how they should treat the United States, their strategy for dealing with the United States after the United States went into Iraq. The document was written in September 2003, 42 pages, detail in Arabic, found by the Norwegian intelligence services.
And what's the plan?
They say specifically that attacking the United States again on our homeland would probably not cause us to pull out of Iraq or leave the Persian Gulf, which is their number one objective. And instead, the document says that they should plan to attack America's allies, to cause America's allies to split away from the coalition, and that would then in the near term impose economic pressure on us. And of course, in the longer term, they may still come back to attack us again. So the document's not saying they're never coming back. But then the document goes on to analyze whether they should hit Poland, Britain, and Spain. And keep in mind, this is in September 2003. They devote 18 pages of detailed analysis to deciding which of those three countries they should hit. The document recommends hitting Spain just before the March 2004 elections in Madrid, and says specifically that if they hit Spain, Spain could not stand two, maximum three blows before it would pull out of the coalition, and then other allies would fall like dominoes, which of course is exactly what happened. The Norwegian intelligence services found the document in December 2003. And as I'm told, we didn't know quite what to make of the document at the time because we weren't quite sure of its credibility. Well, of course, now that the Madrid attacks actually happened, actually as predicted or suggested, we now find the document fully credible.
But if this was information that was available in September of 2003...
Well, in December. It was written in September 2003. The Norwegians say they found it on December 18th, 2003.
All right, so it was...
And I don't know what date they gave it to the Americans. So I'm just telling you what the dates are here exactly. But several months...
Would one assume that they would give it to the Americans relatively soon?
One would assume so, yes.
Because I guess the question I'm asking is that during the presidential election of 2004, the Department of Homeland Security would periodically raise the threat level, suggesting that there might be an attack in the United States, either at the conventions or during the presidential campaigns or during the debates. I mean, we all remember the yo-yo, news flashes that we received from Tom Ridge during that presidential year. Some critics suggested that the information was being used in a political way. And I guess my question is, if this was knowledge that Norwegians had in December of 2003, mm-hmm. you would think that the leaders of our intelligence would have it in 2004, and it seems to me that that document, given the wake of what happened in Spain, it would seem to me that that document flies in the face of what the Department of Homeland Security was telling the American people, or at least they were raising a threat level, and you're saying that this document suggests that there's not likely to be an Al-Qaeda attack in the United States.
Well, I think the way I would interpret the document, and keep in mind I've read the document closely, the way I would interpret the document wouldn't be quite so hard on the Department of Homeland Security for the following reason. This document tells me what Al-Qaeda says its chief goal should be in the near term, that is not to attack the United States, but to focus on America's allies. And the fact that they actually did that and they had success doing that tells me that they have a real strategic logic. But that doesn't tell me that they wouldn't be willing to take a target of opportunity, or there wouldn't be other operations also going on at the same time. I would never go so far as to, I think that the document probably suggests there was something of a deliberate decision not to attack us in the short term. But I think that given the document is coming from our enemy, I would never put 100% credence in a document from the enemy that would tell me they're not going to hit us. So I'd still be cautious about being critical of the Department of Homeland Security.
But if you did say that the principal purpose of the suicide terrorist is to remove foreign troops,
yes,
from the Middle East,
yes,
one would suspect that if there was another direct attack on the United States, given our mindset, that would not cause more troops to come out. It might cause more troops or more bombs to drop there.
Well, at that time, you see, what's really disturbing about the document, I've spent, before 9/11, I spent 15 years of my life studying coercion with air power. I've taught for the U.S. Air Force. I've taught numerous classes. I've had numerous people write analyses of how to coerce other states and other actors. The Al-Qaeda document is not only interesting in its substance, but it's actually quite startling in its quality. It's an excellent coercive analysis, and unfortunately, the metric they used to pick the Spanish was a rather astute metric. And I say this, I'm not happy about this, but the fact is that they chose to simply track the level of public opposition to the war. And in Poland, it was the opposition to the war was the lowest. In Britain, it was medium, and it was highest, 90% in Spain. And that's what they used to to make the decision to go after Spain.
And tip the election.
Well, one of the things we have to worry is, if you'll notice, opinion polls in the United States are dropping about support for the war. We're now in the low 40s. And as you watch those opinion polls go down, I don't think it's only us who are watching those opinion polls go down.
So oddly enough,
this document would suggest that the more public opposition to the war in Iraq grows, the more encouraged Al-Qaeda might be to attack us again.
And the answer to the question, why has there not been a suicide bombing attack in the United States, based on what you said, is that it's not in the plan.
It appears to be a deliberate decision, although I would also point out that we are not an easy target. After 9/11, it was a little too quick to say that we could be hit anytime, anywhere, any place. The fact is, we're not as vulnerable as Israel is to suicide terrorism, because we don't have the enemy literally just a few miles away, and our oceans provide some benefit.
But our borders. I want to talk about the borders. You've got some things to say about the borders as well. We will hear that when we roll on. 1-800-723-8289. Fascinating stuff tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Robert Pape is the guy. He's author of the book Dying to Win. Art Sear from Carthage College is also joining us. 1-800-723-8289. We've got callers. We'll take them when we roll on from Chicago.
Russia will become the greatest economic giant the world has ever known.
An old enemy.
He's sending bioweapons to all corners of Russia.
The man is more dangerous than ever. A new hero.
You realize that if this stuff gets out, there is no stopping it?
Patrick Swayze, Ben Cross, Michael York, Patrick Bergen, based on the best-selling novel. Frederick Forsyth's Icon. Premieres Monday night at 7, 6 Central, only on Hallmark Channel.
Which of the following statements is not true? Shopping for music online is fun. Shopping for clothes online is fun. Shopping for car insurance online is fun. What do you mean shopping for car insurance online isn't fun? Go to Geico.com. It's quick, it's easy, and in no time at all, you could save hundreds on your car insurance. Now be honest, what's not fun about that? Geico.com. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
From Springfield, Illinois, the home of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. I had a chance to visit it this past week. It's excellent. You should get down there and see it. I understand also that the Gerald Ford Library, Presidential Library, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, also is a great presidential library. So what did I say? Museum. It's not the library. The library is at the university. The museum is in Grand Rapids. And our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. We had a caller waiting before the break, and I have left him dangling there. But, Alan, are you still in Kansas City?
I certainly am. Thank you very much. Robert, you know, there's said to be this radical Wahhabi sect in Saudi Arabia that's said to be one of the major financiers of this insurgency slash holy war, if you will, going on in Iraq right now. And it seems to me the House of Saud is just sort of looking the other way. And I'm just wondering what the diplomatic U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship should be right now.
Well, it's a complicated question because, in fact, the government of Saudi Arabia has been working with us to some extent. But, in fact, there are large parts of the Saudi population which don't agree with that. There was a poll taken, actually, by the Saudi's own government in 2002, which was really quite disturbing. The poll found that 95% of Saudi society agreed with Osama bin Laden that the United States should withdraw military forces from the Arabian Peninsula. Now, that's not to say they agreed with the tactics of suicide terrorism to get there, but it is quite a disturbing finding to discover that, in fact, Osama bin Laden's main objective is wildly popular. And I think this is probably true not only in Saudi Arabia, but probably throughout much of the Persian Gulf. And so what that means is that as we work with the governments, as we work with the Saudi governments, the Saudi government has its own problem, which is that the more it works, there's a tension then, naturally, between the Saudi government and its own people, because many people in the Saudi government are quite comfortable with American forces on the ground. So the relationship with Saudi Arabia is especially complicated. And I, for one, although there are some people who think we should be punishing the Saudi government or doing X or doing Y, that's not really my view. I think that, in fact, there's enough fragility in the Saudi government that if we were to try to punish the Saudi government, we may well end up reaping what we sow. That is, that may actually help the rise of more radicals in the Saudi government.
Alan, thanks very much. We've got more callers on the line. Let's go to Guy, listening to us in Nevada, Missouri on KCMO. Go ahead. You're on the air.
No, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to ask Robert and or Art, what they think about us giving $50 million to the Palestinians. And I'd also like to ask them why the Bush administration would call the vigilantes down in Arizona such a thing, you know, the Minutemen.
Vigilantes.
Okay, well, those are really two separate questions, and they're complicated questions. I'll try to be brief. I think that it's a vote of confidence in Mr. Abbas, who gets high marks for integrity, and so far has been able to establish himself as an independent figure from the very powerful influence and posthumous memory of Arafat. So I think it's a positive sign. I also think this administration has been so closely tied to Israel, in contrast to others, including the first Bush administration, that presidency, that this is particularly worthwhile at this time. We're also in a strategic bind. We're heavily committed in Iraq. This war is not going according to the original plan of the White House. And because we're so limited in our capacity to intervene elsewhere, and because Al-Qaeda has such tremendous residual support, I think the more that we can do what the British used to do, that is divide up our current and potential enemies, the better. In regards to your second point, I think there's a very important debate that is very threatening to President Bush in his remaining time in office within the Republican Party stimulated by a number of issues. Stem cell research is probably the most important, but a very powerful secondary dimension is tremendous opposition at the grassroots in the Republican Party from non-corporate Republicans, if you will, to what they see as the administration's tolerance of illegal aliens and illegal immigration into the United States. Representative Tom Tancredo, is now persona non grata. My understanding is that the President Bush has banned him from the White House and is trying to exile him within the Congressional Party. Mr. Tancredo, as you probably know, has been an outspoken supporter of the Minuteman, a critic of the administration. He does things like holding up a giant imitation plastic driver's license made out to Osama bin Laden on the House floor. I think the President is isolated, and I think he's in serious trouble in his party. The vote on Amtrak, the President wanted to gut Amtrak. His own party ignored him.
Guy, while you're on the phone, I want to talk to Bob, because he has some strong feelings about border patrol and border protection, which obviously is at the core of your question, I believe.
Okay.
Bob?
Well, since suicide terrorism is mainly a response to foreign military presence, foreign occupation, and not Islamic fundamentalism, we have to expect anti-American suicide terrorism to continue and actually to grow as long as we have tens of thousands of ground troops stationed in the Arabian Peninsula, and we now have 150,000. So what we need to be cognizant of is that the threat is not declining, the threat is probably growing, and as a result, it would be well worth our investment to consider one of the things that we often don't consider, which is defenses. What we learned in Israel in the last 2 years is that defenses can be much more effective against suicide terrorism than many people think. In August 2003, Israel completed the first segment of a fence, a security fence, which is really three fences and security cameras. It's not just a wire fence.
Right.
When it completed that part of the fence, something dramatic happened. For the previous 3 years, every 12 months, there had been over 20 suicide terrorist attacks against Israel. In the 12 months after the fence, there were only six. Not a single suicide attacker went through the fence, over the fence, under the fence. The suicide attackers got through around the edges where the fence was not completed. That is, that fence caused suicide terrorism to decline by 75%. That has been a very big structural assist in moving us toward peace. And so if we were to do the same kind of fence on the Mexican border. We currently have a 14-mile fence near San Diego, the exact same fence, by the way, right, that the Israelis built. That's a 2,000-mile border. That at $3 million a mile, that's $6 billion for just 1 month of operations in Iraq.
Right. Well, something else, too, that I'd like to express is that I was a resident down in Southern California, east, about 150 miles east of San Diego. And I think that the Bush administration, or Republicans in general, are afraid of disassociating themselves from the Hispanic vote by being anti-immigration.
Right.
But the fact is that through my own experience, is that, you know, where I lived, it was 95% Hispanic, and they were in favor of anti-immigration laws and closing off the border as well.
Right.
You know, Americans. You know, they were Hispanics. Right. They were Americans. And
Guy, I'm not really analyzing this as a politician, and I'm not really looking at the economic impact or the political impact, because my real area of expertise is actually on insecurity.
Right.
And what I can tell you is that defenses have more value than we give credit for by a fair bit, and this is not anywhere near as expensive as some might think.
Absolutely. Well, I concur, because, I mean, how much, you know, you're talking, what, $6 billion to build a fence? Yeah. Along the Mexican border,
right,
and then you consider how much 9/11 cost us,
right, and Iraq. If you just sort of look at what's happened in Iraq, you can see that a marginal increase of $6 billion for something that actually provides some real security, as opposed to just increasing the number of terrorists coming at us, is a reasonable thing to think about.
Thanks very much for your call. We do appreciate it. Let's go to Susan listening to us on WRKO in Boston. Go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to speak about to the professor about him saying Saddam Hussein propositioned the Palestinians to become suicide bombers.
Yes.
And he would pay him $25,000 to do it.
Right.
That's not true. When he heard of somebody being a suicide bomber, and then the Israelis would come and destroy the family's homes, he would give the families of that suicide bomb money to rebuild. He did not proposition the suicide bomber to do it.
Well, Saddam actually came in a little later into the game, and it's not clear. We actually don't have...
I lived over there for 10 years, and the truth is not represented over here in America.
Well, how would you describe the truth, ma'am?
Regarding?
Regarding the relationship.
The Palestinians have no right to defend themselves, is the what is going on over here. I get very emotional about it because the truth is just not represented. The Palestinians have no rights.
Well, I don't...
to defend their land. I've seen how they were tortured, how they were treated, like they're nothing less than animals.
Would you agree that there are two separate issues involved? One, Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, and two, Saddam Hussein's support of Hamas and other terrorist organizations. Can you differentiate between those two?
I don't have proof of that.
Hamas had operatives in Iraq. It's part of the public record.
No, they did not. No.
He not only publicly, well, he not only...
It's a charitable organization. They do a lot of good. Actually, no, I mean, bottom line, they're defending what they feel is their right. That's all I really wanted to say. It's just that it's so misrepresented over here.
Okay, thanks very much for your call. Back shortly, 1-800-723-8029. More calls when we roll on from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Sergeant Arlie Ermey, United States Marine Corps. While our armed forces defend our freedom, their families shoulder household duties and emergencies alone. To help, the veterans of foreign wars and Vermont American brand bits and blades have created the Unmet Needs Program.
John Fergus here, the VFW National Commander. Please help us help our military families by visiting unmetneeds.com and by purchasing Vermont American bits and blades. A portion of every purchase goes to help.
Visit unmetneeds.com and buy Vermont American brand bits and blades. Thank you and Semper Fi. Hoorah!
Dead.
Tyler, we've been over this three times. There'll be no adults at Ed's house Friday night. No party for you.
But the whole class is invited.
Making sure an adult's there isn't easy. But if you don't, your kid's more likely to do drugs.
You are so stubborn.
Well, now you know where you got it from.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
From Seattle, Washington to Austin, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on Memorial Day 2005. Thank you very much for joining us. And also, don't forget, tomorrow at 11 o'clock, take a moment and think about all the men and women that have given their lives in service to this country. You know, we ask everybody to do it just one day a year. We should be doing it more often than not, and certainly in families where there are loved ones serving now or those who have paid the ultimate price. You think about it probably every day. But tomorrow is the day that the rest of us can take a moment. And so at 11 o'clock tomorrow, bow your head, say a prayer to whoever you would like to say your prayer to, and give respect and show respect to those that have given their lives for this country. Joining us tonight is Art Sear. He is author of the book After the Cold War. He's the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College. That's in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And also joining us this evening is Robert A. Pape. He is author of a book called Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. He is the director of the Chicago Project on Suicide Terrorism. Also, he formerly taught international relations at Dartmouth College to our friends in Hanover, New Hampshire, who are listening to us this evening. And also, he taught air strategy at the United States Air Force School of Advanced Studies. And before we take more calls, during one of the breaks, you were talking about how this whole project came about, because you are... You're now the world's foremost authority on suicide terrorism. How does that happen? Because a lot of people were involved, foundations were involved. Tell us about your team, the interpreters that you had.
Well, what happened?
It's an incredible story about how you got all the specifics. In the case you just tuned in, Bob has gone back for all of the terrorist suicide terrorism in the world since 1980, and he's tracked each and every attack. And talked about the attacker, and it's an incredible research job. How did you go about putting it all together?
Well, I started to do it shortly after 9/11, when I discovered that it was so difficult to answer some of the questions about suicide terrorism because our data was so thin on the attacks and on the attackers. Well, 2 years after that, I published my first article on the subject in an academic journal where I collected my first part of the database of suicide terrorist attacks from 1980 to 2001. Well, once that was published and it became circulated, I knew beforehand that no academic or think tank had ever collected such a database. But what I didn't know until after I published it was that no government had done that either. Our own government, which of course collects statistics on terrorism, well, it turns out that we did not collect statistics on suicide terrorism before fall of 2000. And of course, after 9/11, we're all busy, the CIA, DIA, they are putting a lot of hours in, but they're not putting hours in going back to the 1980s and 1990s. They're putting in lots and lots of time on what's coming at us at the moment. So shortly after I published it, a number of foundations contacted me and were willing to support still more research. The Carnegie Corporation, the University of Chicago did, Argonne National Labs did, even our own Defense Department did a part. And so it became the case that I could put together a research team, and I had an idea, which was that if I was right about what was motivating suicide terrorists, then in fact we should be able to find lots of information in the terrorist local communities about the suicide terrorist attackers themselves in their own language. So I put together a research team that spoke native languages, the key ones, Arabic, Hebrew, Russian, Tamil, some others, and we even were able to send individuals to collect information on the black markets in Beirut and Cairo. And so we were able to actually collect a mound of fresh and new information from the terrorist community themselves, sometimes even from the terrorist groups who that produced albums, almost yearbook-like glossies, to celebrate suicide terrorists in their local community.
Having looked at them all now, paint the profile. Who are they?
Well, Dying to Win, I collect demographic data on 462 suicide terrorist attackers who actually did the mission since 1980. That is, they weren't attempters. These are people who actually killed themselves. And the striking thing about it is that they rarely fit the standard stereotypical profile of a depressed, lonely individual who's uneducated, who's living on the margins of society, seeking to end some sort of wretched existence. In fact, most suicide terrorists are socially integrated, remarkably productive members of their societies. Many are from working class and middle class backgrounds. They're technicians, waitresses, ambulance drivers, teachers, security guards, paramedics. Very few are criminals. In fact, for most, their first experience with violence is their very own suicide terrorist attack.
Do they have families?
Many have families, but very few because of their ages. And we could talk in we of those 462, we know the names of 333, the ages of nearly 300.
What's the average age?
Well, they're not as young as you are probably led to believe from the papers. Before I did this, I thought I was going to find suicide terrorists who were 12, 13 years old. Well, the youngest suicide terrorist in the entire data set of 462 is 15 years old. That's the youngest. There are no 14-year-olds or 12-year-olds or 11-year-olds.
What's the average age?
The average age is about 23, but what's important is actually the distribution, because now, of course, we have nearly 300 ages. So, and that's the average across all the groups. So the average age varies, and you get some very interesting age distributions, especially between men and women. You see, one of the big differences between a male suicide bomber and female suicide bomber is not whether one is more secular or more religious than the other. Actually, it's just the age. It turns out female suicide bombers are often over the age of 24, over nearly half, 46%, whereas men, only about 22%.
Now, for those that just tuned in, your premise, your paradigm shift here, is that it is not religious fanatics that tend to be suicide bombers. It is those who come from maybe secular backgrounds, who may be part of paramilitary organizations, and they look at it as political strategic move, not related to religion.
Of the 462 suicide attackers, no more than half actually come from a religious background. Over half come from a purely secular background. And I'm not saying that religion plays absolutely no role, but the fact is that the main motive for suicide terrorists is they're mainly acting out of a duty to respond to a foreign military presence on the territory they view as their homeland, and then sometimes religion is used as a recruiting tool in the service of that.
Because they're all gone and you have not been able to interview them, this is all speculation that you're going to give now, but let me ask the question. Somebody joins a paramilitary organization and or a guerrilla organization, and they're dedicated, they have a specific political cause, and maybe there may be hundreds or thousands in that group. But the suicide bomber comes out of that. They rise through that system. Do we have any inkling at all as to what is it that triggers someone to go from a member of a larger guerrilla group to wanting and being able and willing to give up their life for their cause?
Well, first of all, you're quite right. We can't actually interview them. So we're never going to be able to kind of finally sort out the bottom of it. But one of the things that's very helpful to realize is that suicide terrorist organizations create an environment in which altruism is valued highly. How do they do that? Well, one of your previous callers mentioned that Hamas does a lot of charity work, and she was obviously quite proud of the charity work that Hamas did. Well, it's because it's real charity work. It's not gobbledygook charity work. It's not phony charity work. Hamas really provides actual charitable services to people who are maimed, to women who have their husbands killed. And what that does is it breeds a lot of belief inside the local communities that Hamas is serving the community good. Well, what does that do? It doesn't create an altruistic individual per se, but what that does is create an environment where an altruistic individual can be highly confident that his altruistic sacrifice will be rewarded and regarded highly by the community.
Now, what we've read, and this is where it comes back to religion again, what we've read is that one of the reasons, one of the motivation is they're going to go and meet Allah. So that there is a religious, you know, tenet there.
Well,
that's more than just a political
tenet. Well, that's true for that. There's a religious tenet there for at most half. So we can't
only
say
half.
Only half, and this is true even of Muslims. One of the things that the book does is we actually have quite astonishing data on the Lebanese suicide attackers. And it's from 1982 to 1986, there were 41 suicide terrorist attackers from Hezbollah who attacked targets, American, French, and Israeli targets in Lebanon. Of those 41, only 8 are Islamic fundamentalists. 27 are communists or socialists opposed to religion. 3 are Christians. And it's not this picture that I'm painting for you of Hezbollah is something that astonished me, because as I was studying this before, as I studied terrorism before I studied, actually got the data, I just assumed everyone in Hezbollah was an Islamic fundamentalist. Well, Bruce, I'm going to show you from my book 4 of the pictures of the women Lebanese suicide attackers. And I want you to look at those 4 women.
Yep.
They're in Western clothes, makeup. Okay. The woman on the lower left, she is
one
the
looks like a model.
She is the Christian high school teacher with a BA.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. Lots of callers on the line. I promise we will take calls the rest of the way when we come back from Chicago.
A horse owner, you should know that West Nile virus remains a deadly threat for virtually every horse in the U.S. Protect your champion with West Nile Innovator, the original West Nile virus vaccine. No West Nile vaccine has been proven more effective or protected more horses, with more than 16 million doses safely administered coast to coast. Ask your veterinarian for West Nile Innovator today, or visit equinewestnile.com. From Fort Dodge Animal Health.
I'm a reporter, and when a story breaks, I have to do my job, even when I'm congested from my worst allergies. Fortunately, I found Claritin B. Now, I'm Claritin Clear.
25 seconds, Tom.
Claritin B gives me non-drowsy, long-lasting relief from even my worst allergy symptoms, like congestion and sinus pressure. Nothing is stronger or faster than Claritin B. It takes on my worst symptoms and leaves me clear.
5 seconds.
Get tough on your toughest allergy symptoms. Live Claritin Clear.
Use as directed. Comparisons are among oral OTC allergy products.
From El Paso, Texas to Las Vegas, Nevada, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head to Spokane, where Mike is listening to us on KXLY. Go ahead, Mike. You've got a question for us.
Thanks, Bruce, and hello to your guests. You mentioned the Lincoln Library, Bruce. C-SPAN had a great section on the Lincoln Library.
Yes, but very well done.
Yeah, two quick questions. What can an American citizen do to prevent terrorism, such as phone calls or phone numbers? And two, are there any warning signs of terrorism?
Well, the key thing to say is that when you say phone calls, what can the average citizen do? There's a tremendous amount that happens naturally after a suicide terrorist attack, that the citizenry being alert and being extremely what that's doing is it is putting pressure on, it's not only being alert and making phone calls, but it is putting pressure on government officials to tighten up homeland security and border defenses. Now, it's true, they can also go overboard. So I'm not trying to defend everything the Department of Homeland Security has done, and especially some of the measures, the intrusive measures that came out of the Justice Department under John Ashcroft, I thought were probably a little over the top. But the fact is, that general response is the appropriate response.
Let's go to Michael in Los Angeles, listening to us on KOGO. Go ahead, Michael.
Hello. Gosh, you hardly know where to begin. Let's look at the Muslims a little bit, and the interesting subject you brought about communists and, you know, a few Christians and Muslims. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that in Spain at one time, you know, we sent over a thing called the Lincoln Brigade, and they were a bunch of communists fighting keep Spain communist, and Franco, of course, was fighting the communist power. Some of those claimed, you know, Christian background. I doubt if the Christians that you cite were anything but simply fallen away Christians. We have to understand that most of those, I mean, we're fighting Muslims. And those people are unbaptized, and you'll notice that there's a threat.
Do you agree with that premise?
Well, actually, I think the most interesting thing about your comment is that's how if you confronted a Muslim with by saying that Islam, there's something evil in Islam which promotes suicide terrorism, what they would do is actually respond the same way you just did, that no, these are not good Muslims, these are bad Muslims, Muslims who have fallen away from the true correct path, just as you're suggesting with this Christian woman. The fact is, we don't know that. We don't have that level of detail about her background to know whether she's a fallen away Christian, a good Christian, exactly what this is. But just notice how easy it is when it does become somebody of our own community to start to say that's not really, they're not one of us. Well, that's because what's happening is they're using religion in the service of a broader strategic objective. It's not coming from the true religion itself.
Let's go to Bill in Westchester, Illinois on WLS.
Yes, good evening, and thank you for a wonderful discussion.
Thank you.
I want to make a point here that somebody alluded to, which is the kamikaze pilots, the Japanese kamikaze pilots, were true war heroes who did something extremely sensible. And we were, I totally support the American side in the war, they were attempting, and I think the O'Hare Airport is named after a pilot who crashed his plane into a Japanese carrier in 1942, I think, doing the same thing the kamikaze pilots did. And I think we should, I'm going to read your book now. You've persuaded me to read your book.
Thank you.
Who's the professor from Carthage College? I can't get his last name. I'm looking for him on the internet and can't
Sear,
get
him. Sear.
C-Y-R.
Arthur okay. Sear.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's go to John listening to us in Chicago, also on WLS. Good evening.
I didn't understand that last caller at all, but I do think that there is a great parallel and at least something to look at between pre-World War II Japan and the problem we have with suicide attackers. And another question to ask is, gee, why aren't any of these suicide or homicide bombers coming from Turkey? In both situations, if you take a look at feudal and our imperial Japan, you take a look at the Wahhabian or off the map Muslim world, the thing that they have in common that draws out this barbaric activity and this behavior is that they have traditionally subjugated women. There have been a number of other books written and what have you that talk about the civilizing influences of women in a society. And you even take a look at urban America and some of the problems we have in which the roles of women and their ability to be able to civilize men and the respect that they don't have anymore, and the fact that they are subjugated as well. I think that when you get a society that does not recognize and respect women, you're going to end up getting barbarianized.
Well, John, thanks for asking that question because it gives me an opportunity to talk about the Al-Qaeda suicide attackers. Dying to Win is the first book that studies the entire set of Al-Qaeda suicide attackers from 1995 to early 2004, the 71 who actually died to carry out Osama bin Laden's orders. We actually have no idea how large Al-Qaeda is beyond this, but this gives us the first look at the part that we care about. Four of them came from Turkey, and Al-Qaeda suicide terrorists are actually over 10 times more likely to come from a Sunni country with American combat troops stationed on its soil than another Sunni country. And because you're so interested in Salafism and Wahhabism, the book actually disentangles that as well, but I don't really have the time to tell you.
We'll do it on another broadcast. Art Sear, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Author of After the Cold War, a professor, the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College. Art, thanks very much for being with us. And your student did pretty well tonight. Robert A.
Penn. All the credit. None of the blame. All the credit, Bruce.
He is author of the book, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. It's probably going to debunk most of what you think you know on the subject of suicide terrorism, and I think it's probably destined to be a huge bestseller.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And thanks very much for spending a couple of hours with us tonight. The world's foremost authority on suicide terrorism. He has been our guest. We'll have him back again in the future. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio and Wilbur Entertainment. Charles Campbell and Tom Veracruz helped make this program possible. Again, reminder, don't forget, tomorrow, pay your respects to those that gave their lives for America. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Arleigh Ermey, United States Marine Corps. While our armed forces defend our freedom, their families shoulder household duties and emergencies alone. To help, the veterans of foreign wars and Vermont American brand bits and blades have created the Unmet Needs Program.
John Fergus here, the VFW National Commander. Please help us help our military families by visiting unmetneeds.com and by purchasing Vermont American bits and blades. A portion of every purchase goes to help.
Visit unmetneeds.com and buy Vermont American brand bits and blades. Thank you and Semper Fi. Hoorah!
Know the greatest phrase ever invented in shopping? No, it's not. I'll just wait in the car. The greatest phrase is, no thanks, I'm just looking. I mean, what freedom, what liberation. What a great way to buy car insurance. In fact, why not do some looking right now? Go to GEICO.com. It's quick, it's easy, and you could save hundreds. You know, saving money looks good on you. GEICO.com. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
When you take 15 girls hiking, you've got to stay alert, even with bad allergies. Hey, stay together! Now I'm Claritin Clear, which means I'm in control of my allergies. Only Claritin is proven to make me as alert and focused as someone without allergies. Claritin gives me 24-hour non-drowsy relief from my worst symptoms like sneezing, runny nose, and itchy eyes. No cell phones in hiking. Stay focused. Live Claritin Clear.
Try Claritin Ready Tabs free. Go to Claritin.com. Use as directed.
If you're a horse owner, you should know that West Nile virus remains a deadly threat for virtually every horse in the U.S. Protect your champion with West Nile Innovator, the original West Nile virus vaccine. No West Nile vaccine has been proven more effective or protected more horses with more than 16 million doses safely administered coast to coast. Ask your veterinarian for West Nile Innovator today or visit equinewestnile.com. From Fort Dodge Animal Health.
A Hallmark Channel original movie.
Russia will become the greatest economic giant the world has ever known.
He's sending bioweapons to all corners of Russia.
A man is more dangerous than ever. A new hero.
You realize that if this stuff gets out, there's no stopping it?
Patrick Swayze, Ben Cross, Michael York, Patrick Bergen, based on the best-selling novel. Frederick Forsyth's Icon. Premieres Monday night at 7, 6 Central. Only on Hallmark Channel.
A party at Ed's house. Okay. Will Ed's parents be there? Then the answer is no.
Making sure an adult's there isn't easy.
No, his brother being there isn't the same.
But if you don't, your kid's more likely to do drugs.
No, I don't care if he is old for his age.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for a Drug-Free America.